What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
Zuby is a rapper, author, speaker, and coach. He graduated from Oxford and is quickly becoming an international sensation. In this conversation, we basically discussed everything we aren't allowed to. We talked about politics, guns, religion, social media, gender, and many more controversial topics. I really enjoyed hearing Zuby's perspective on the world, and I find his interest in Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies to be quite telling. This is a great episode, so I really hope you enjoy it.
Skirt, skirt!
Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at crypto.com. Go help your boy out. Tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit crypto.com. Pomp's got you, always. Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you got to do is go to coinmine.com. You buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right. You purchase it. It shows up at your doorstep. You pull it out of the box. You plug it in. Connect to your Wi-Fi. 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com, tell them Pomp sent you, and thank me later.
As many of you know, crypto investors store their digital assets on exchanges or in cold storage for long-term safekeeping. However, this strategy doesn't help them grow their investment holdings or build overall wealth. With the new BlockFi interest account, users can now securely store their Bitcoin or Ether at BlockFi and receive 6% annual interest paid monthly in cryptocurrency. 6% is an absurdly high rate. It's the best rate in the industry. I highly suggest you go check out BlockFi.com/pomp. Again, that's BlockFi.com/pomp to sign up and start earning crypto today.
If you follow Bitcoin and crypto, you've probably heard of eToro. They're the world's number one social trading platform, and I love it. They've got more than 10 million other traders that love it too. And guess what? They just launched in the United States. eToro offers access to the world's most popular cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin, Ethereum, and others. With the smartest trading tools and the ability to connect with the best traders around the world, there's no better place to build your perfect portfolio. If you're new to Bitcoin and crypto, you can test the waters with their $100,000 virtual trading feature. But if you're more experienced, you can create custom technical charts and use eToro's social feeds to inform your trading decisions. They've got transparent fees, and so you never miss out. They also have an easy-to-use application available on iPhone, Android, or any web browser. You can get started today in just a few clicks at eToro.com. Again, that's eToro.com. Get VIP access to Bitcoin and crypto markets today.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys. Bang, bang. Zuby's here. I feel like the man, the myth, the legend. All right. We got a whole bunch of shit to cover. Let's start with who the fuck is Zuby? Like who are you?
Okay. So I'm Zuby, independent rapper and creative entrepreneur, author of the book Strong Advice, Zuby's Guide to Fitness for Everybody, host of the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. I am an independent hip-hop artist. Of course, also a podcaster, writer, occasional public speaker, occasional fitness coach, occasional life coach. I do a whole bunch of stuff.
All right. So look, you've been at this a really long time. We were talking before we started recording, 15 years in the making, and now it's like everyone has discovered you.
But there's a lot of hard work that's gone into this. Before we get to the hard work, though, let's talk about the video in February.
Okay, yeah.
What is this video that just exploded on the internet and kind of brought a bunch of attention? Then we'll go back to kind of what you did before before that video went popular.
No problem. So on the 26th of February, it's still my pinned tweet on Twitter. I posted a video of me doing a 230-kilogram deadlift. And in the caption of the tweet, I wrote something like, I keep hearing about how biological men have no physical advantage over women in 2019. So watch me destroy the British women's deadlift record without trying. P.S. I identified as a woman while lifting the weight. So don't be a bigot. And I wrote that thinking that, you know, a number of my 19,000 followers at the time would find it funny. But I realized within about 10 minutes that I'd created an absolute monster. So that tweet's now done almost 7 million impressions, over 2 million views on the video just on Twitter alone. And it got picked up, you know, it went crazy. I think the video got about 10,000 views in the first 10 minutes. And then within an hour, it had cracked 50,000. By the time I went to bed that night, it was at 300K. Woke up in the morning, over 500,000. And it just kept going. I was gaining like 100 followers an hour for several weeks. And it just kept going and started getting picked up by the media, BBC, Sky News, Fox News here, Sky News in Australia. It just went crazy. Then Joe Rogan picked it up, talked about it on the podcast, shouted me out on the podcast.
So I remember. He was like, get that dude in here. Get him in here.
So that brought a whole nother wave. And it just kept growing and snowballing and just been getting all these new opportunities. I've now been out here in the States for 9 weeks. It's my very last day in the States. This is my...
Oh, it's last day?
Yeah, I'm going back tonight.
Oh, man. Yeah, well, thank you for coming to spend an hour with us.
You're welcome, man. You're welcome.
All right. So what was the video like in terms of what chord did it hit? Because it obviously, you posted it trying to be funny, right? Mm-hmm. And there's plenty of people who laughed, but it also really resonated with a lot of people. And I think that's what really drove kind of the attention to it. Like, what is that chord of society that it struck? Is it just that you were just being honest and saying stuff that people normally don't feel comfortable saying? Mm-hmm. Or like from your perspective, what did you hit?
I think it hit a whole bunch of different nerves. I think firstly, it's one of those issues that's at the cross section of lots of different areas of society and culture. So there was, you know, there was sort of like, obviously, just in terms of the sports itself. So it kind of hit the sports world. It hit the whole kind of socio-political world. It hit the, I don't know, like obviously it went into the kind of LGBT world.
Yep.
It went into in multiple countries as well. And it's one of those issues that's been going on for a while. Some people are very aware of and privy to, some people are not, but it was a very hot button topic at the time. I didn't realize how much so until it went viral. Because, of course, you got the Olympics coming up next year. So they've been trying to decide what the rules should be in that regard. You've had multiple stories from different countries of, you know, transgender women or men identifying as women or whatever the case is, breaking women's records, winning their races, beating them in fights, various sports, all this kind of stuff. And it's one of those issues where I believe that over 90% of people are actually not in favor of that being able to happen, right?
I think
if you went out and pulled people on the streets, regardless of their political views or whatever, and you just asked people, do you think someone who's biologically male should be able to compete against biological women in sport? Most people would say no in private.
Yeah.
But publicly, we live in a time where there's a lot of things where people are afraid to voice publicly for a lot of repercussions. And I think it was also the fact that I wasn't even explaining the point. And there was no anger.
Yeah.
There was no malice. There was no anything. I was just like, okay, these are the rules. Cool. I'll play by these too. And I'll use your own rules to show you why this is a bad idea.
So does the new record stand or did they say, no, this doesn't count?
So the video that went viral was actually just from a training session.
Okay.
It wasn't in a sanctioned competition. To set an actual record, it would have to be in a sanctioned competition, which I didn't do. But
could you have done it? Like, is that part of what the rules are today? Could you walk in and say, I identify as a female, break the record and then walk away?
It depends on the league. I know the U.S. APL, the U.S. powerlifting organization, I know that they've banned it. So okay. It's so not allowed. But so it depends on the from sport to sport. It depends on the federation.
Got it.
Some of them have different rules. Some will say, okay, you need to. I think in the Olympics, for example, now they're saying you have to keep your testosterone below a certain level for 2 years, and then anyone can compete in the women's, which is a terrible rule still. And then there's other ones where it's just self-identification.
Got it.
So you can just, anyone who, you can just literally do what I do and say you identify as a woman and
go smash the record.
Yeah, go smash up the records. Yeah. It's probably worth saying as well that I can lift 100 pounds more than I did in that video. That wasn't remotely close to my maximum, but that was kind of the point. It was like, I don't even compete and I can crush this record.
Well, and I think part of it is, the way I see the world is it's actually not binary either, right? It's not like, hey, you should be able to identify however you want, right? Or you can't, for example. Because then you get into things like transgender, right? Which is, well, what if you are biologically one gender, but then you switch, right? It's more than just psychologically or kind of mentally saying, hey, I identify as something. Mm-hmm. Now you've actually taken steps physiologically to transfer or change your gender, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And so when you start getting into this world, like, I don't know if there is a good answer, right, to a lot of this stuff. But, like, it is so complex, especially when you then overlay the socio aspects of it.
For the sports thing, I don't think it's complicated at all.
Okay.
I think it's very simple.
What is it?
You've got two solutions. This is why I think it's ideological rather than a push for genuine inclusivity and fairness, right? You can either have two rules, right? Either one, you can have a separate transgender division in whatever the sport may be. It's unlikely you'd have enough people to compete in that.
Yep.
And so that may not
be. So you'd have male, female, and then transgender.
Yeah, that's one option.
Okay.
Or you can have what already exists, which a lot of people aren't aware of. Most male sports are not actually male sports leagues. Okay. There's any rule in the NBA, MLB, and, you know, any of these sports divisions, NFL, that explicitly says a woman can't compete.
Mm-hmm.
But for obvious reasons, there's no woman who's good enough at American football to compete with the best in the world in American football.
Yep.
Same with basketball. Same with any sport, essentially.
And that belief is more because of the biological aspect of just
absolutely
men are bigger, stronger, bigger, faster. Stronger.
Yeah, exactly. We know this. That's why you split them up to begin with. Mm-hmm. So you could just have an open division. And then if you've got an open division, then regardless of whatever someone's, you know, gender identity or whatever the thing is, if they're good enough, they can compete in that competition. Yeah. And then it's fair. And then you're not sacrificing 50% of the population to appease perhaps one person.
Yeah. Well, I think those are pretty fair and simple solutions, right? It's just like, look, let's not try to put people in boxes. Actually just say anyone who's the best, come compete.
Exactly. Because it's not about, you know, even the point I was making. It's like, I'm just talking about facts here.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't discriminating against. This isn't even really saying anything about my thoughts or anyone else's thoughts on this whole issue. It's just like, look, if you're talking sports, it's got to be fair. It's got to be even safety.
It's science.
It's simple science. It's basic science. And it's even safety and, and security, right? If you do have someone like myself, right? Mm-hmm. You know, someone like yourself and you're competing against, like, there are pretty much, apart from like a very small handful of women who were like super duper elite and in many cases like jacked up on steroids, right? There are almost no women in the world who are like, there's tons of guys in the world who are stronger than me.
Of course.
Right? I'm a strong guy, but there's tons of guys in the world who are stronger than me. There are almost no women in the world who are stronger than me, right? And so it's crazy, right? Like, I used to play rugby and stuff. Like, if I just went and if I tried to play against the English rugby team, men's team, I'd get crushed.
Yeah.
Okay. If I identified as a woman, but I would probably immediately make
the
English like national team, just pure physicality, speed, strength, etc. Like, I'd just be running through them because there's just a difference.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So this video, and I jokingly put in the, we're live on Twitter for those that are just listening. And I said that you're a 15-year overnight success, right? Which is how these things tend to work. Let's go back 15 years before this, okay. Right? So my understanding is you split time growing up in Saudi Arabia and London. Is that right?
UK. UK. Not London, okay. Specifically, yeah.
Got it. And so what kind of after childhood, what did you do leading up to your big moment on the stage of Twitter?
Yeah, sure. So I grew up in Saudi Arabia. I moved there when I was one. My family lived out there. My parents worked out there. So I went to school there from preschool all the way up until fifth grade.
Okay.
When I was 11, I actually went to boarding school. So I went to the UK and I was back and forth between the two countries for about 9 years. So I did 7 years boarding school there, did really well in school, got into Oxford University, went there, studied computer science. That's where I started my music career, actually.
Was studying computer science at Oxford is where you started music.
So I started rapping, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. Bit of a weird origin story.
You know what I love about this, though, is everything that, and before we start recording, we were talking, I actually was following you before the deadlift thing, right? And so when the first time I heard Rogan say, like, hey, where's this Zuby dude? You know, whatever, like, go get that guy. I remember being like, wait, what? The guy, like, you know, whatever. And I wish I remembered why I followed you, but for whatever reason I was. But it's all of the things in the traditional, like, way of life, right? That, like, your parents say, hey, you know, be really smart, go to school, get a great education, you know, go get your degree, go get a job, like, all this stuff. Like, you did a lot of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And you blew up because of a video where basically you just said what everyone's thinking and no one wants to say, right? And so, like, to me, there's some comedy to that, right?
Yeah,
this new world that we're in, even though you went to Oxford, you studied computer science, right, all this stuff, that's what explodes, right?
Yeah. And I mean, that video is actually a good metaphor in quite a lot of ways because, you know, I often joke that it took me to identify as a woman for 9 seconds, and that's what brought so much attention and opportunity to me. But, you know, one of my friends made a really good point on it, and he was like, you know, it took you 15 years to make that. He's like, almost nobody could make that video because almost nobody can lift that weight, right? So he's like, it took you, there's a whole backstory behind you even physically being able to do that. And that's like a good metaphor for everything else because it's like, you know, most people can't just stroll in the gym and lift 500, 600 pounds.
Yep.
It's taken a lot of work and training to get to that level. So although it seems like it was just that one moment, if you kind of look back behind the curtain, back it up. There's a lot behind that. And I think that's really how everything's been for me.
Got it. And so what was the interest at while you're there at Oxford studying computer science? Where'd the interest in music come from? Were you into music kind of as a child or was it just at one point you decided, hey, I want to go do this?
So as a child, I used to play piano and I used to play trombone for a little while. I used to do recitals and stuff like that. But I wasn't really a music fan. I wasn't really a listener initially until I went to boarding school. And then I really fell in love with hip hop when I was like maybe 13 or so. Started listening to lots of like Nas, Jay-Z.
Oh, Eminem, Nas, One Mic, Dre. Man.
Yeah, man. I was, yeah, even before that album, I mean, I was listening to like It Was Written.
Yeah, I used to run home from school and what was it? TRL, remember, okay, with Carson Daly here in the US? And they would play the top 10 songs and One Mic like dominated.
Oh, really?
Like a year. And I remember they play music video, right? Yeah. Got the chair sitting in the room and they break the glass. Yeah. And he was like, oh, this shit's awesome. Yeah,
music used to be a lot more exciting in a lot of ways. I think the speed and ease of consumption now has somewhat devalued it. But maybe that's me being a little boomerish.
Okay, boomer.
Yeah, so I was a fan. You know, I was a fan. And then when I was in my first year of university, I was going to Nigeria for a vacation.
Okay.
And I got stuck in an airport in Paris.
Okay.
And I was by myself, had like 24 hours to kill, basically. And I didn't have much on me. I had my MP3 player and I had like a notepad. And I just started jotting down some lyrics. And it came to me fairly naturally for someone who, considering I'd never done it. Yeah, it came to me fairly naturally. So I kept doing it and I would just take my phone and record my raps.
Oh, so you were writing the lyrics and then recording on the phone?
Yeah, just recording them into my phone. Oh, yeah, yeah. That. So just super duper basic. And then I kind of started getting the confidence to play it to people.
Yep.
And, you know, people are like, yeah, that's pretty good and whatever.
And were you editing music in underneath it or this was all kind of like a cappella?
This was pretty much a cappella at the time.
Okay.
And then when I got back to university, one of my friends, Chris, had just like a basic recording setup in his dorm room. And so I would go on a website, I don't know if it's still going, soundclick.com. Mm-hmm. It was like way before SoundCloud and before YouTube even pretty much. And I'd go on there and producers would put up beats. So I'd download beats and, you know, just rap over them. So I recorded my very first song was a song called The Bad Man.
Okay.
Which is funny, like lots of my friends at university, that's my nickname with them, The Bad Man. So I recorded that song and then I followed it up with one called Oh No and another track called Tonight. And I kind of had these three songs and I was just putting them out to, you know, friends in the universe, friends in my
university. What was the reception?
It was really positive. It was really positive. And to be fair, like, I mean, I can, obviously if I go back and listen to them now, I'm like, okay, like I've gotten a lot better.
Practice.
But it's not that bad. Like it's not, even now if I listen to it, I'm not like, phew, that was terrible.
You know, it's
like, okay, you know, I picked it up really pretty fast. And then I actually released my first album, Commercial Underground, when I was in my second year of university. So after I'd been rapping for about 9 months, I released my first album. And I just initially started with a run of 50 CDs. I just did 50 CDs and I just went around the university and sold them to my friends and people I knew for like £5 each. And I sold out of them in probably 2 weeks. And so I was like, okay, so I took that money, I reinvested it, I did, you know, another couple hundred copies and sold those. And that, you know, and that was that realization point of, okay, you know, if it's one thing for someone to say, okay, I like your music or you're good at rapping or whatever. But if someone's willing to pay for a CD, then I'm like, okay, there's something happening there. So I started doing more gigs. I did a couple gigs where I was still living in Saudi Arabia at the time. I actually did a couple gigs there at some of the schools.
And what's that like, man? Yeah, what's living in Saudi Arabia like?
Different, man.
Different. I can imagine.
Yeah, a lot of stuff different. Where I lived was very much an expat community, so it was a little bit of a bubble.
Yep.
So in terms of the culture kind of within that little 1,500 people.
Yep. You get some aspects of the Saudi Arabian culture, but more so expat.
Yeah, there it's very expat. But then if you go out, you know, into the city or anything, you want to go shopping, you've got to go into the city. And then you're in the real Saudi where, you know, the usual rules and laws and regulations and everything apply. So it's cool. Like I have a very positive view and memories of growing up in Saudi Arabia, which surprises quite a lot of people. You know, I think people expect me to talk about how awful and scary or whatever it was. And I'm like, nah, like it was, yeah, I loved it. I loved it.
And what was their reception when you come back and now you're producing music and I'm assuming you're trying to sell the CDs and stuff in Saudi Arabia. What was the response in terms of, you know, kind of you coming from the UK, right, with music that I don't know if they listened to it or not or whatever, but what was that response like?
So I wasn't really pushing my music beyond my sort of local community or anything in Saudi.
Yep.
I was doing that in the UK initially. Eventually I started just going out on the street and just doing street hustle. Just, you know, once everyone I knew had my music already, then it was like, okay, cool.
I took all the money I could from everyone I know.
I need to take it to new people. Yeah. I mean, I've sold over 25,000 albums out of a backpack pretty much, man.
That's fucking awesome.
Thank you.
And this is like literally on, so we're recording this in New York City, like on the street corner, you walk outside, people will hand you a CD, right? And people in New York basically like, hey man, get out of my way, right? Mm. But all the tourists, et cetera, they grab the CD and next thing you know, they're asking for money,
I don't know. I don't do it like that. I hate that, man.
All right. How do you do it?
I don't do that, man.
What did you do?
I'm upfront. So I'll see, hey, what's up, man? You know, what kind of music do you listen to? If you're, you know, if you got the time and you're interested, you say, okay, I like some hip hop, whatever. I'm like, cool. I introduce myself, tell you what I'm doing. And I'd always have my headphones. I'll have my music. I'll have my music loaded up on my phone. Like, yo, have a listen. Look, this is my album. This is how much it costs.
Yep.
I'll play you some tracks. If you like it and you want to check it out and support what I'm doing, then here we go. So I don't like that whole thing.
It's way more authentic that
Authentic, man. I don't like this. I don't like this thing of giving it to someone like it's free and then like pressuring that. I wish, and there's a few people who would do that in the UK, and it kind of messes up the game for
everybody else.
Cause it's like, I don't want people to think that's my approach. And no, I'd rather just be honest with people. And you know, if someone doesn't want it, it's totally fine. You know, I'd have like promotional cards as well. So with my social media and YouTube and everything. So it's like, cool. No worries, man. Have a listen online. And if you like it, you can also check it out.
A theme across this whole kind of evolution of your life and your career is it seems, at least from my perspective, you've gotten very, very good at producing things that people want, which is half the battle. The other half is how do you get it in their hands, right? Sure. How do you convince them to buy it?
Yeah.
And whether it's
the merchandise, it's the CDs, it's the book. You know, we'll kind of talk about all these different things. Mm. You put a lot of work into figuring out how to sell stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And once you understand how that works and how the human psyche works and kind of what motivates people to actually purchase something, the product is interchangeable. Right. And you kind of move it across different aspects of what you want to push in terms of what you're optimizing for.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of it is just being real with people and knowing your audience and getting people to like you. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't make people like you, but if you know who does like you and you know why they like you, then everything kind of becomes easy from there. That's why, you know, this year my focus has really just been on building the audience.
Yep.
And letting people know who I am, letting people know what my message is and whatever. I found that wherever I go, like from city to city, country to country, whatever now, even in different zones, I can go and talk to Tucker Carlson on Fox News and then go talk to Joe Rogan and then go talk to like a school teacher here and talk to, and it's, there's like a common thread mm-hmm. through it all. Like these things might seem really disparate mm-hmm. and not connected, but I find that if you're just authentic and you're true to yourself mm-hmm. and you're honest with people and people just like your demeanor and you're positive, then people will want to support you.
Yep.
And you know, you're encouraging and helping people and all that. And you know, opportunities just kind of will come your way.
Yeah.
You know, I think good people who are on a certain level vibe kind of find and will resonate with each other.
Yeah. I mean, look, to be completely honest, the reason why I wanted to do this was I was like, hey, man, that's going to be fun.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'm sure he's got some things that he must talk about, whatever, but like, that would just be a fun conversation to have. And I think that when you give off the vibe of, hey, you're authentic, right? It will be fun to have a conversation with you. That's where you can attract all these different types of people who just say, look, I don't even have an agenda, right? As much as I just want to enjoy a conversation with somebody who I don't feel like has a hidden agenda, who isn't trying to sell me something, you know, blah, blah, whatever. So today you've got, you've got an album, right?
Eight
albums, but what's the latest one?
Perseverance.
All right. And where can people find that?
That's on iTunes, Spotify, my website, teamzubi.com. All the places you'd get music from.
Okay.
If you want to stream it, if you want to download it, just search Zubi on any platform. If you want to get a CD, then my website.
Merchandise. Tell me the story of how, like, where did the idea for the merchandise come from? Mm. Team Zubi is fucking fantastic marketing. So just what's the story behind the merchandise and then Team Zubi name?
Yeah, sure. So I released my first bit of merchandise in university as well. So I made one t-shirt for myself, and because I had someone made a logo for me, the Zubi logo. It's the one with the two dots. It's different from that one. And I was thinking of, I was like, okay, I want to make a t-shirt for myself to promote mm-hmm. my music.
Yep.
And I didn't want to just have the logo on it. I thought that was a little boring. I think it mm-hmm. needed something to capture people's attention. So I was toying around with lots of different ideas, and eventually I came up with I'm down with Zubi, are you? So those shirts, anyone who went to university with me will recognize that shirt.
Okay.
Because I used to wear it all the time. I just had a black shirt with white writing, I'm down with Zubi, are you? Right? And so people would always ask questions. They'd say, oh, someone's asking, what's the album name? The album is called Perseverance. I just got the t-shirt for myself to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then my friends at university started being like, hey man, like I want one too. Yeah. I want one of those t-shirts. So I went back to Saudi and I got like 10 printed and I just gave them to my best friends at university. So like there were just a bunch of us who were going around with these black t-shirts saying, I'm down with Zubi, are you?
That's awesome.
Yeah, and people would like see them and be like, am I down with Zubi? Like, what's Zubi? You know, because it makes people ask, what's Zubi?
Yep.
Right? So that started happening. And then eventually I started selling that one t-shirt mm-hmm. alongside my album. And then eventually I did them in like a range of like 20 different colors. And I did girls ones. And, you know, I'd have people come into my gigs and stuff wearing them. And it sort of expanded from there. You know, people wanted hoodies and mm-hmm. then hats. And it's gotten to a stage. I think I've got one of the widest merchandise ranges now in the UK.
Really?
Yeah. I've got a really broad range of stuff now.
Pretty big thing. Yeah. And to me, like, again, what I take away from that story is there's a lot of people who, sitting in college where everyone wants to kind of conform to being the popular kid and kind of the social norms, et cetera, frankly, they just wouldn't have the balls to walk around with the shirt with their name on it.
Most people still don't.
Right? Yeah. And especially after college, right? But definitely during college. And there's a thing that I've seen on Twitter specifically where the people who are most authentic are the people who are least scared of being embarrassed or failing in public, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What you're talking about is having done that in real life and being willing to have the self-confidence to walk around with your own name on your shirt.
Yeah.
But then it becomes a thing,
yeah.
right? And once it becomes a thing, then people want it, right? And you just kind of build off of that. But it really comes from that element of like not being scared to just do what you want to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I've really learned that. I mean, a question I'm getting a lot now, I did a meetup in New York last night, which was awesome. A lot of people came. But a big question I get is, man, how do you deal with all the big people see the negativity and crap I get on social media? Yeah. And people are like, man, dude, how do you deal with all that stuff? And I was telling my story about going out and selling 25,000 albums on the streets of the UK. I mean, do you know how many people I had to talk to sell that many albums? Mm-hmm. Like I've spoken, when I'd say I've spoken to like 500,000 people, I'm not exaggerating. And this is like in real world, face to face. So I've had every rejection, every way that somebody can say no, every way someone can show disinterest. I've had that multiple times. Mm-hmm. And I know my mission. I know who I am. I know what I believe. So it's like there's nothing anyone can say to me, whether that's online or offline or whatever, that's going to just sort of, you know, make me feel super duper sad or want to give up or anything like that. Like I just use it all as ammunition, fuel. Like I write some of my best songs after I've been like, you know, when like people are talking a lot of crap, I'm like, okay. Like let's switch it.
It is this belief that, and again, a lot of this, people don't understand, there's pressure, there's negativity, et cetera. It's what sports athletes and celebrities dealt with 20 years ago.
Sure.
Today, the quote unquote average person, if they grow a following online, they get the same stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And it's, actually, in some cases, they didn't ask for it, right? So you see these people who go viral who, you know, they caught in their worst moment or their best moment or whatever, they just get sucked in. And there's people who, you know, like yourself, which you were looking to promote your music, right, your merchandise, etc., but you also get pulled into an area of the world where maybe you didn't intend to be there either, right? Exactly. And so, you know, it's a positive side of, hey, you create this video, it goes viral, right? And it kind of started as a joke, whatever. But you didn't ask for all the hate. Right?
Oh, no. I didn't know it was going to go that far.
So how do you deal with it? And do you ever just wake up and say, like, I don't want to do this anymore, right? Or like, today I don't want to deal with this?
No, I mean, look, you can always log off. That's what I always tell people, you know, when people talking about like cyberbullying or like this or that, I'm like, look, no one is forcing me to be on Twitter. Mm-hmm. No one's forcing me to be on YouTube, Instagram, whatever. So yeah, sure. The stuff can be annoying.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally I might need to mute someone or very rarely block them if they're just being they're just being complete idiots. But ultimately it's like, it's my choice. And in the real world, like I love my life. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm very happy. I've got a wonderful family, wonderful friends, great girlfriend. Like, life is cool. So I'm not going to let what's going on in this world. Like, I can just put this down here. And I'm not worrying now about, oh, what's going on Twitter or whatever. It's like I choose to look at it as much as I want. And then also the love outweighs it like 30 times. Right? And for every 30,
of course,
you know, I get all these lovely DMs and great people, and I'm seeing people in real life who I'm meeting or telling me I'm helping them, inspiring them. They like what I do. And then, yeah, you get the occasional, well, now it's more than occasional, but you know, you get some random avatar on Twitter calling you a mean name.
They're always anonymous, right?
Always anonymous, right? And it's just like, okay, like why would I let that ruin my my day? That doesn't even make sense.
For sure. So you're on an 8-week tour in the U.S., right?
Yeah, 9 weeks now.
9 weeks. Okay.
Weeks, yeah.
What's been the craziest thing you've done, or like the most fun, memorable thing?
Wow, a lot of stuff.
Like I've been watching on Twitter. You've done stuff. you've been all over the country. What did you say? You said L.A., San Francisco, Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth. Where else? Atlanta,
Nashville, D.C., New York.
Jeez, man. Yeah. You've seen more of the country than most Americans have. What do you think is the most memorable thing from the whole trip?
Man, I'd certainly say one aspect has been, you know, having the opportunity to do so many awesome podcasts and shows and meet people who I, you know, greatly admire and who I listen to and everything like that. That's been really dope. One cool thing has been the meetups. So mm-hmm. I did the very first meetup in San Francisco. I just literally tweeted out, hey, anyone want to go get dinner in San Francisco? And 2 hours later, I'm there sitting with a bunch of people who follow me on Twitter, and we're just having great conversation and good food. And so I was like, cool, I can do this in other cities. Yep. So I did one in Atlanta. I did one in Nashville. Did one in DC. Had New York last night, which was probably the biggest. And just, man, that's amazing. I'm an independent rapper from the UK. So to be
You're, according to Tucker Carlson, when you were on TV, a famous rapper from the UK.
Famous rapper from the UK, yeah.
So those that don't know, Zuby went on a Tucker Carlson show on Fox News, and I saw a clip this morning before we got here, and underneath him, where they usually put, you know, founder of X company, CEO, whatever, it just said famous rapper from the UK. Yeah. And I said, that is the most OG thing I've seen on television in a long time.
Yeah, I did crack up when I saw that, because I watched it live when they broadcast it, and I was like, oh yeah, I like that. I was like, I'll take it.
I'm gonna get a business card made with famous rapper from the UK.
Yeah. So the meetups were great. Like I was saying, just knowing that, having people in every city who care and who like me and who like want to just go and hang out for a few hours and talk. And
well, and you went to the White House.
Yeah,
right?
I went to the White House.
And you were saying that while you're in the White House, people are DMing you being like, yo, I heard you're at the White House. Like, can I come meet up?
Yeah, so I've got fans in the White House and the Pentagon and all these places I didn't know, because you don't know who's watching. You don't know who's listening. You don't know who's following.
You get Trump to blast some Zuby in the Oval Office.
Yeah, it's. I didn't get a chance to meet the president, but maybe next time.
Whoever is working in the White House, he said next time he's coming back.
Yeah, I'm coming back, man. I've been there twice now. But yeah, I mean, like last week, do you know Dan Crenshaw?
Yeah.
Like he DM'd me.
He's the man.
Yeah, he followed me on Twitter and DM'd me and was like, yeah, you know, I saw your interview with Ben Shapiro. Like, really like what you had to say and this and that. Andrew Yang followed me today.
Andrew Yang
followed me, and Scott Adams followed me today. So it's like it's just interesting seeing it kind of grow.
We got to talk about this, right? Yeah. There's like an underground culture community, right? So you just named a bunch of them. So there's, you know, Scott Adams, Andrew Yang, Rogan's in there, the Tim Ferriss is whatever. And for whatever reason, a lot of them tend to be males, right? But these are all people who I think have built very large audiences and very loyal, engaged audiences around being more rational, I think, and kind of not bending to the cultural pressures, right? And so each one of them has their own thing, right? You know, like Yang's running for president, right? And he's very different than, Crenshaw or Shapiro or whatever. But does it say something about the fact that there's so many different people who take the same mechanism of just, I'm not going to bend to the cultural pressures. Yeah. I'm going to speak, you know, my truth. I'm going to be rational. That they all are gravitating towards you who are you're doing the same thing, you're just doing it a different way, right, on different topics.
Yeah, exactly.
But do you think that there's like almost camaraderie around the fact that, hey, I respect somebody who's willing to just say what they believe and not conform?
Yeah.
Or do you think that it's more just coincidence that those are the types of people?
No, it's not a coincidence. You know, a lot of people think a lot of the, you know, been having a lot of political conversations a lot, and a lot of people think, you know, everything's left versus right, right versus left, conservative versus liberal on everything. And a lot of it is more like, in this current climate, a lot of it is more like reasonable, rational people versus like unhinged, crazy people.
Yeah.
You know, it's really more like that. Like it's you could take someone who I, in terms of, I don't know, political policy, like I almost disagree with them on every issue.
Yeah.
But as long as like, but I'm reasonable, they're reasonable, we're not going to like scream at each other or call each other evil or call each other Nazis or whatever, you know, like just, we're just going to be reasonable, decent human beings, and we can chill, we can be friends, we can have great conversations, whatever. Yeah. It's just, you know, but you've got people on fringes who, yeah, they're just, you know, really emotional and angry. And
and part of this is, I think, why like Rogan specifically has blown up in mainstream media or kind of culture is, if you look at all of the mainstream media, they're optimizing for the inflammatory, salacious headlines, you know, audio clips, etc. So what they actually are doing is they're enticing and incentivizing people to be on the extreme.
Exactly.
Right. And so take their coverage of Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Donald Trump, AOC, you know, just down the line. It's across the aisle. Just they want the salacious, inflammatory stuff. But I've now listened to Rogan interview Bernie Sanders, Andrew Yang. I've learned more listening to those interviews than I've ever learned from the mainstream media.
Of course.
And it's because it's a much more rational conversation that doesn't have interruptions. And it's, what do you believe about healthcare?
Yeah, sure.
What do you believe about X?
Yeah.
Can we return the mainstream media back to kind of that rational, less salacious world?
No.
Or is it stuck and it's just going to continue accelerating kind of on the extremes?
No, no. It's not going back.
Why?
Because of the format.
Okay, explain
right.
That.
So when I was on Tucker Carlson, I had 6 minutes. Right?
Solve the world's problems. Six minutes.
I had 6 minutes, 6 minute segment to discuss some pretty new, like I think I handled myself well, but you don't have a lot of time to expand. You've got just the format of television, because you've only got 24 hours in a day, and each host or whatever has, you know, 30-minute show, 1 hour show, whatever. You've got plus the ads. So it's all really, really short bits. And there's no real way to expand that. Like Rogan can sit there for 2, 3, 4, 5 hours and talk to someone. And if there's something that, you know, we're doing this podcast now, if there's something that I say which needs clarification, you can be like, oh, what do you mean when you said that? Or go into a little more detail. And on TV, you can't do that. There's just
the nuance not is
the
time. Lost.
No. So you've just got to have the sound bites. And as you said, it incentivizes everyone to be a little more extreme and shouty and irrational and emotional than they could be, right? When I saw, I watched that one. In fact, I watched all of Joe's interviews that he's done with Democratic candidates, right?
And has he done any with Republican candidates?
No, because there aren't any. It's just Trump.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah,
there aren't.
He did Tulsi as well.
Yeah, Tulsi, right? Yang, and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I got
I'd love to hear him and Elizabeth Warren. that would be fascinating.
Yeah. But I saw her on the Breakfast Club. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, so there you can at least understand where people's heads are at and get more of their personality and everything, rather than this, you know, stand on stage and shout at each other for 5 minutes.
Yeah. I actually saw there was, I don't know if it was a petition or someone was just tweeting about Joe Rogan should moderate a presidential debate.
He's not down.
Yeah. Well, one, I could just imagine him just be like, fuck this. I'm out, right? Like in the middle of it. All right. So let's talk a little bit about Bitcoin and crypto, because that's actually what we're supposed to be talking about.
Of course,
what do you know about Bitcoin? What's kind of your view coming from, like, more of a music, writing, kind of creative type, you know, focus in life. You blow up online, et cetera. Bitcoin in the community that's listening right now is, you know, it's a say-all be-all, right? They're obsessed with it. Cryptocurrency is going to take over the world, et cetera. That's not a world that you necessarily come from, but like, what is your perspective as to how this fits into the world?
Yeah, sure. Well, I've got an entire song called Crypto Currently, which is...
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a song on my latest album that's all about...
Oh, we're going to tweet that out for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I think I name drop like at least 40 different cryptos in there. Go listen to that. It's interesting. It was a bit of a thing of wordplay. I wanted to make a song where whether or not you knew, you understood the references, the song would still make sense.
Okay.
So
when did you record this? 18? 2017?
2018.
2018. Okay, so 2018. Like after the big mania and it was kind of still
popular. Yeah, when it was blood in the streets.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in terms of my own investments, I'm still waiting to, you know, get back in the black, because the timing of my investments was not too great. So I first heard about Bitcoin. I mean, I'm a computer science grad.
Yeah.
So I actually heard about Bitcoin, I hate saying this, like somewhat early, maybe like 2012 or 2013. Like I heard something, but I never looked into it. I thought it was just like an in-game currency or something like that. Or like something like PayPal.
It was one of a lot of different versions that were out there in the world, right? It just happens that this one ended up being worth $160 billion market cap, right?
Yeah, I just never looked into it. I didn't understand the fact that it was fully decentralized and, you know, people didn't know who the founder was. And that it was deflationary and limited in number, and that because it's unique, right? It's the first time you've had a digital anything that is not limitless, right? And I didn't research it properly until 2017.
Okay.
And that was when I was like, oh, like for me, it was actually a pretty easy sell. because I'm quite libertarian minded and I'm aware of a lot of the issues with like central banks and just the money system in general, and the way that it's even been abused both in history and also in different countries, right? So in a country like the UK, a country like the USA, people don't need to be irrationally concerned with like massive, what do you call it, when they just start printing
inflation.
Money. Yeah, inflation, hyperinflation. There's a word though, isn't there? When they just do the money printing.
Quantitative easing.
Quantitative easing. So I've seen what happened in my lifetime in places like Zimbabwe, seeing what's happening, you know. And so I remember one of my friends in boarding school coming into school and he'd have like $500 billion notes and stuff.
Billionaire by age 22.
He just have this money. Like he'd just be showing us all these notes and we're just like, what on earth? Like what's going on in your country, man? So for me, it was actually a fairly easy sell in terms of the value proposition. So I think it's a really interesting world. That's certainly how I came to follow you.
Yep.
And I follow quite a lot of people in the crypto world and things like that. So I do think that it's a very exciting space. Like I wouldn't go as far as saying I'm an evangelist, but I'm very like pro Bitcoin, pro crypto.
Look, to create a song about it, right? You obviously know more than most, right? In that sense. Yeah.
Skirt, skirt.
Want to know who has the best URL? Crypto.com. That's right, crypto.com. They're a crypto platform with one goal, motherfucking mass adoption. That's why we're all here. We're trying to get crypto in every wallet. Crypto.com is helping people do that through buying, earning, lending, and card payment. Everything you could want at crypto.com. Go help your boy out. Tell him Pomp sent you. Download the app or visit crypto.com. Pomp's got you, always.
Ever wanted to get into mining and didn't know how? Don't worry, your boy Pomp's got you. Everybody got some electricity and Wi-Fi. All you got to do is go to coinmine.com. You buy a coin mine. It's like an Xbox or a PlayStation that helps you turn your electricity into Bitcoin. That's right. You purchase it, it shows up at your doorstep, you pull it out of the box, you plug it in, connect to your Wi-Fi, 5 minutes or less, you're mining Bitcoin. All you have to do is control it from the mobile app they provide, and then you receive over-the-air updates that add new coins and new features on a consistent basis. Kind of like how Tesla does over-the-air updates and updates the car software. Just you're updating your coin mine. Consumer mining made easy. That's right. Go to coinmine.com. Tell them Pomp set you and thank me later.
One more word from our sponsor, BlockFi. Their new interest account allows you to securely deposit your Bitcoin or Ether at BlockFi and receive 6% annual interest paid monthly in cryptocurrency. This rate actually compounds, so you receive a 6.2% APY, which is very attractive given the alternatives. So you can actually take your Bitcoin, you can deposit it with BlockFi, and get paid an interest rate of 6% in return. Go check out BlockFi.com/pomp, again, BlockFi.com/pomp, to sign up and start earning interest on your crypto today.
What do you kind of feel like in terms of, so you have what I'll just call retail channels, right? So you're selling music, you're selling t-shirts and gear, etc. Do you accept Bitcoin? Have you ever thought about it?
I was going to say teamzubi.com does accept Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, and Ethereum.
Oh, nice. All right.
I don't think I've ever actually done a sale in crypto, though, but I do accept it.
Okay, so that was going to be part of my question. Yeah. What was the thought process? Was it just, hey, I want as many payment options as possible, and this is another one that I think people might use? Or was there some other thought process behind accepting Bitcoin?
Yeah, well, I thought, if I'm telling people about Bitcoin and I'm invested in it and I believe in the idea and everything, then it only makes sense for me to accept it. And so... Yeah, I think it's making a little bit of a statement as well. In fact, that's something I'll probably start shouting about a little bit more because until now I almost forgot that my website does take Bitcoin. just because
after we release this thing, if you talk about it, I'm sure somebody will give you some Bitcoin.
Yeah, because it's not for the average person who comes across my music and my merch, it's not their usual currency
for sure.
So I haven't pushed it too much, but Yeah, I'm very. It's. I keep a pretty close eye on the space, and I remember. Yeah, I just think it's exciting. I mean, I saw like I'm 33, so I remember seeing where, you know, I remember when people didn't think that email addresses had value. Mm-hmm. I remember when people didn't think that, I've been on Facebook since 2004. I remember when people didn't get Facebook. Like, people were like, well, what's the point of this thing, mm-hmm. right? Because the network effect hadn't really mm-hmm. taken place yet. I remember the adoption of mobile phones, let alone smartphones. Mm-hmm. All these things, which at the early stages, I remember the way people talked about them is the way a lot of people talk about Bitcoin now, both on the skeptical side.
Yep.
And also on the like pro
yep.
in favor of the adoption side. And so I'm like, okay, like there's a lot of really smart, brilliant, interesting people who are talk. I think with anything, if there's a lot of like smart, interesting, intelligent, trustworthy people who are interested in anything, mm-hmm. it's probably worth
spending some time on it
and at least researching, okay, there's, you know, what's going on there. So that's kind of part of what it was with me. So I feel like I'm starting to ramble. So let me pause there, because I don't know what question I'm answering right now.
All right. So I want to switch gears. I want to talk about just kind of the cultural implications of a lot of what's going on in mainstream media, politics, et cetera, okay. right? So one of the aspects of Bitcoin and the crypto world, or kind of the ethos behind it, is this whole idea of like, don't trust, verify, mm-hmm. right? And it's this idea that our entire lives, I'm 31, so we're about the same age. Mm-hmm. We've grown up being told trust institutions, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's banks, whether it's media organizations, whatever. Like, those institutions are the ones who are going to not lead us astray, right? Mm-hmm. We can trust them, and that's the way to go. The internet broke that monopoly, right? And the internet basically exposed the corruption and the propaganda and like all this stuff. And that shift is going from the institutions now to verifiable news sources or information sources, and also individuals. Mm. One of the things that is interesting to me is when you overlay the people who are speaking truth, right? So whether it's the Rogans, the Shapiros, the Kanyes, like anybody who kind of fits in that bucket, with this idea of don't trust, verify, mm-hmm. what you get is you get a relationship between the audience and the actual source of information, right? The individual, mm-hmm. not the audience and the institution.
Gotcha.
So you remove that layer, you're at the forefront of this, right? You've got music with no record label, mm-hmm. right? You've got merchandise you're selling directly to people. You've got a book you're selling directly to people. Like, people are subscribing directly to you on Twitter and listening to you, et cetera. Like, where does this go, right? Because you're kind of encapsulating now like where we are today. Mm. But you've been very opportunistic and very kind of smart and forward thinking about how you've navigated up to this point. In your mind, what are you excited about, and where do we go here as those institutions continue to lose power and we shift more and more to this individual model?
Wow. One thing I think that has already happened, whether or not people realize it, and is going to happen more, is I feel like everyone now is actually their own media company.
I agree with that.
Yeah. I think every...
Explain why you say that, though.
Yeah. So we're living in a time and place where individuals are empowered to create and distribute and sell off the power of themselves. Mm-hmm. The tools are essentially free to do it, mm-hmm. right? We're recording this podcast right now. We're live streaming it. So we're creating content, distributing it in real time all over the world. Like, it's basically magic. Like, doing something like this used to cost thousands and thousands of dollars. Like, you'd have to go in a studio, pay for studio time, you know, have someone engineering it, mm-hmm. and do this. And then if you wanted to distribute it, you'd need to, you know, have a record label, mm-hmm. or a distributor, which would place, like, think of music. Like, let's not do podcasts because that's kind of newer. But with music, mm-hmm. you need trucks traveling all over the country, literally dropping records into the shops every week, and then people have to physically go there. Now you can just record a song on your laptop or in a studio, home studio, whatever, and you can just distribute it immediately. Mm-hmm. You can put it up on YouTube, on SoundCloud. If you wanted to get on iTunes, they've got 24-hour turnaround now on like iTunes and Spotify. I could just record a song tomorrow and drop a new single on Monday. And I could shoot the music video over the weekend. And like, this thing.
Smartphone, yep.
Dude, this isn't a phone. This is like a whole computer.
It's a computer, supercomputer.
The camera here is better than the most expensive camera in the world like 15 years ago.
Yeah. Well,
it's crazy.
And here's the part to me is it's not only the mechanism that you're describing, it's the scale, right? So between you and I, we have almost 500,000 followers on Twitter, right? The most popular television shows in America get about 500,000 people to watch it for an hour.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Right? And you and I, who we're no smarter than anybody else, right? But we built up these followings. We flip
well,
on.
Well, we might be. But.
Well, I was going to be nice before the anonymous Twitter trolls come after us. But yeah, actually we are. But we flip on, you know, live on Twitter, and we both tweet it, right? Whatever. All of a sudden, we actually can garner a larger audience than some of the most popular television shows in America.
Yeah, it's nuts.
But with that responsibility and power, or with that power comes great responsibility, right? And it's this idea of you see the negative effects too, because there's other people who have audience who they just start saying crazy shit,
of course.
Right? And they start and it's just complete misinformation, etc. How do individuals balance those two? How do they, is it a trust thing? Is it a, I trust Zuby and when Zuby talks, I listen because I followed him for 15 years and he's built up that trust? Or is there some other mechanism in which makes you the good actor and somebody else the bad actor in the minds of an individual?
I would certainly, the latter option sounds very frightening.
Mm-hmm.
Because who would be that authority who determines what's real and what's fake and what's true and what's false? Like, I think that would be kind of going back to what you've kind of already got, but probably making the problem worse.
Isn't that what the social media platforms are doing today?
It's what they're, but that's a big problem, right? Okay. That's a big problem. They're censoring people, shadow banning people. You know, people are seeing political biases leaning in and stuff like that. That's a problem, which I think, you know, a lot of people are talking about it, and I hope that does get solved. So I think it's more the former. I think it's coming back down to just that human level interaction of, but just on a bigger scale.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beautiful thing with the internet. It's weird with social media because all the stuff we're doing, you're almost not supposed to be able to do. This is what I was saying when I did the meetup last night with people. I was like, we're not all meant to be here. You know, like we're not like the way that I was able to set this up and the fact that we're all connected and
it's crazy.
You know, and I'm there and people are there telling me all this stuff about myself. And I'm like, I'm almost like, why do you know so much about me? But of course I put it out there. It's like, I followed you on Twitter for a year. It's like, of course you know a lot about me.
Yeah.
But it's odd because this is our first time meeting face to face and human beings aren't really designed for that. You know, we're supposed to be in these little small tribes and communities. Well, or
what's the weirdest thing somebody said to you on this trip that you've been like, wow, you really know me.
You really know me? Man, I think maybe I can't think of one specific thing, but I think maybe people just knowing so much about not just even my views, but like even my background, especially because I've done all these podcasts and interviews and stuff where people have asked me about growing up in Saudi Arabia or this or that. So I've had people just kind of want to go deeper and, like when you were talking to Ben Shapiro, you said such and such. Like,
that's
what
pretty
do you
cool.
mean by that? And so I'm like, okay. Like, so it's cool, but it's weird. I just think that – I don't think that people have really realized just how magical the time we're living in is. And and it's going to get crazier. I mean, now there's 4 billion people online now. It's predicted that by 2030 it's going to be 7 billion. So the number –
10 years.
Yeah. The number of internet users – I mean, think of all the people in places in Africa, South America, Asia who don't yet have full internet access but will – within the next 10 years. What's happened in the Western world in the last 10 years, it's like that's going to happen again in even more populous places. And I don't think people are even kind of aware, let alone ready for that. So the world's going to keep getting smaller. People are going to keep getting more and more connected. And I think that the opportunity that will come with that is tremendous.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the challenges and risks and dangers, both on an individual level and on a sort of collective community level, have some concerns. I mean, we've already seen that in the past 12 years. You're seeing things like anxiety and depression and even suicide rising as social media use rises, people feeling more lonely, all that kind of stuff. So It's just a tool. Mm-hmm. It's a tool, but you know, this thing can be a weapon of mass destruction in there.
How do you deal with like the digital addiction stuff? Right. Because you have a very large engaged audience. Right. And one of the things I think about a lot is if you wanted to 100% optimize for mental health, mm-hmm. you'd walk away from it all.
You would. Yeah.
Right. Absolutely. You just be like, I don't even need a computer. Yeah. Right. But it's an incredibly powerful tool, mm-hmm. and especially when you're building a business. Right. And you're kind of building this community, et cetera. How do you balance it?
Mm. I think it's about being cognizant and having a level of self-awareness, mm-hmm. and knowing that the addiction is a genuine mm-hmm. risk. So if I'm having this conversation with you and I'm not having it, but you know, you might have times where you're using your phone a lot and you find yourself like reaching for it or wanting to reach it, or maybe you checked it 2 minutes ago and you're checking it again 2 minutes later. Like I'm very self-aware of stuff like that. So I fight it. And I'll be like, oh no, let me
stop. You got Android or iPhone?
Android.
Android?
Yeah.
All right. So on the iPhone, they have now it'll tell you how many notifications you get, how much time spent.
Oh, yeah.
One of the data points is pickups.
Oh, okay.
First time I looked, it was like I was picking up my phone like 18 times an hour. So yeah. I was like, what the fuck am I doing? Yeah. Right? But it was great because by measuring it, I became cognizant of it. And then I was like, all right, man, can I go 5 minutes? Right? Can I go 10 minutes? And the pickups went down. But it was scary.
It is.
Right? Imagine picking up an object 500 times a day.
Yeah.
Crazy. Yeah.
And it's at almost everybody at any given moment, their phone is within arm's reach.
For sure. Even when they sleep.
Yeah.
Right.
So that's one thing I do. I sleep with my phone in a different room.
Ah.
I sleep with it in a different room and I turn it off.
So you, before you go to bed, shut it off, leave it
shut
in a different room.
Shut it off, put it in a different room so that.
And then you go to sleep, wake up, got to go in the other room.
Yeah. I don't even want to risk having it next to me. You know, if I need to wake up in the middle of the night and use the bathroom, I don't want to be, oh, maybe I got some new tweet, you know, like.
Yeah.
Let me not even run that risk. Just put that away and then my brain doesn't.
I like that.
Think about it. Yeah. And also to de-screen, because you get that, you know, the light. I've got the blue light filter, mm-hmm. but even just for your own sleep, just so that you're not staring at a screen and then going straight to bed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very good for your sleep. And then, you know, just all the physical stuff, balancing it with the real world things, meeting friends, family, going to the gym, training, exercise, all that.
We're laughing because someone on the live stream just said, I'm trying to put my phone down right now and I can't do it. I need help.
Yeah.
Speaking of Twitter, what's the Twitter strategy?
Like, I can't tell everybody.
Nah, come on. You gotta tell the secret. The thing that you've done a great job of is you get really, really high engagement on Twitter.
Yeah.
What is that strategy that you have? And it may just be, hey, I'm authentic, right? Mm. But like, what do you kind of think about when you think of Twitter?
Yeah. This is one of the next quarter. We're working on a book and course about this.
Ah.
What
is it called? Like, how to be good at Twitter like Zuby?
I don't know. Maybe like Twitter domination or something like that. Because you can make money on Twitter too. So my Twitter strategy, well, a lot of it is about authenticity.
Mm-hmm.
It's about having fun too. Mm-hmm. Like if I'm not having fun, I stop. Right? When I've stopped having fun, like I put it away. If it's getting too much, people are just getting too angry too. It's like, let me leave this for a while.
Yep.
Because you've got to maintain a sense of humor. That's one thing that also. You were talking about what a lot of different these people and disparate things have in common,
mm-hmm.
beyond authenticity and telling the truth. It's having a sense of humor as well.
For sure.
It's having a sense of humor. We're living in a time where some people are just taking themselves way too darn seriously. Way too seriously. Like, you know, someone cracks a joke and someone's like, well, you know, it's just like.
It just happened with Bill Gates. Did you see this?
No.
So Bill Gates was on stage. Now, let me caveat this whole thing before all the trolls come out. I have not watched it.
Okay.
I've only seen people tweeting about it.
Okay.
But from what I gathered from the tweets this morning, it was Bill Gates was on stage. He was asked about Elizabeth Warren and the wealth tax.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically was like, look, I've paid $10 billion in taxes. If you want me to pay 20, that's fine.
Yeah.
Right. But if you want me to basically pay 90% of my wealth, right, like I start doing some math and I'm basically like, you know, how much is left?
Yeah.
Right. And then supposedly he laughs and he says, just kidding. But of course, that first part of, you know, Bill Gates doesn't want to be taxed, you know, his 9% as well, whatever. Well,
I'm confused as why he said, just kidding.
Well, so again, I haven't seen the whole thing.
Okay, I was a fair concern.
But the whole thing is
you get somebody who it appears to be he was joking. Okay. So forget whatever the joke was. But people immediately they take a piece of the quote, right? And it becomes this whole thing, yeah, and it's controversy, etc. And all I could think about when I was reading these tweets was like, people are coming at Bill Gates,
Oh gosh,
the guy who's agreed to give away 99% of his wealth.
Yeah, of course, man, dude, no one is immune.
who has almost, you know, eradicated the globe of polio? we're mad at that guy. Okay,
it doesn't matter. That's the thing to these people. It does not
like
matter.
Warren Buffett gave him all the wealth because he said you're going to be better at doing good for the world than I am. So I here take all my money and go do stuff with it,
dude. It doesn't matter how much good you do, how much positivity, whatever. You're still gonna. You just cannot appease certain people.
Crazy.
And so I don't even try to. That's one of the things that, like, that's happened to me. Like there, that was one switch that went off for me in 2018. It was like, you know what? I'm not even going to try. You know, like if someone just wants to be angry at me or hate on me or write mean comments or whatever, just regardless of what I do, I'm like, screw it. Like, okay, I'm not even going to try to win you over because you're just so weirdly entrenched. If you want to have a conversation or you've got a fair criticism or something, happy to listen.
Yep.
If you're just going to jump in there and just be shouting and angry, I'm like, dude, like whatever, mute. Yeah. You know,
you're a big muter, but not blocker.
I don't like blocking. I really like some people really, really push it to the point where okay, like you're just disrupting stuff here, you know? But yeah, mute is better. I'd rather just let people like keep shouting, but I can't hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we were talking about Twitter strategy. So okay, so coming back to it, it's about having fun, being authentic. I like to start dialogues and debate. Sometimes I just put stuff up because I want to see kind of what people debate back and forth. Like I'll put up polls and things like that. Like I had one famous poll I did, which was which one's a greater threat to humanity, feminism or climate change? And 80% of people voted feminism. But the comments on it were just amazing.
How did you come up with that? Like, what the fuck went through your head before you tweeted that? Were you just like, look, man, I really want the trolls today?
No. Like, to me, it was actually – see, it sounds like a trolly question, but I think it's actually – some people are like, this is a stupid – I'm like, I genuinely – like, I don't actually think that's a silly question.
But
I don't actually think that's like on one level it sounds silly, but when people sort of like really, really think about it, especially, you know, people who recognize some of the issues of modern day feminism, it's like, well, that's a fair question. And there were some really good responses to it as well. Some people were like, well, you know, because da da da. Other people were like, da da. And so, I mean, 30,000 people voted in the poll.
I love it.
So, So it went really far. You know, it got like, I just wanted to see the discussion. So I was like, and I didn't put my own opinion. People got angry at me. And I'm like, I was like, hey.
Okay, so this is one of the things that I think Twitter has done a great job of doing accidentally is in society off of Twitter, there are sacred cows. Sure. You can't talk about, like that question, you can't ask anybody that. Like, are you crazy? Like, you're an asshole, right? On Twitter, you actually can ask the question, and the fact that 30,000 other people wanted to participate and discuss it, it's like, hey, you know what? Like, that's not your fault that 30,000 other people, like, you're talking about something that obviously other people want to talk about.
Yeah, yeah.
And the thing about polls on Twitter is all anonymous, right? Yeah. So when you vote, nobody knows who voted for what. And so, yeah, there's some bias, right? So if I ask about crypto stuff, whatever.
Of course, you know your audience.
Yeah, but still, it is very, very interesting that Twitter allows for this conversation to happen that you can't.
Yeah, it was amazing. And it was amazing how many women voted for feminism, by the way. That was
all right. So while we're on the topic of Twitter, you're not an American citizen, right? We've got President Trump, who has taken Twitter and used it as a tool unlike any president in any country in history.
Mm-hmm.
What is your view of him, the Twitter usage, kind of everything in general in terms of the U.S. government versus other countries you've lived in? Because you have this really interesting perspective, right? Saudi Arabia and the U.K., those are pretty different.
They are.
Then compare those two to the U.S. right now, really different.
Really different.
So you kind of have a much more well-rounded view and have lived in those environments. What's your take on kind of what's going on politically and with Trump?
Yeah, it's hilarious. It's fantastic.
That might be the best description ever. It's hilarious.
It's brilliant. All right,
before you elaborate on this, so I was actually in Nigeria, in Lagos, when Trump, I think it was that he, because what, November 4th is election. Yeah, so it was on the election night.
Okay.
The next morning in Nigeria, I was sitting in the hotel with my buddy, and it was in the papers, right? You know, Trump was one. And people were laughing.
Yeah.
People were just like, yo, he won. Yeah, like they couldn't believe it, right? Yeah. And these weren't Americans. These were Nigerian citizens who were just like, you gotta be kidding me.
A lot of people in Nigeria like him.
But they loved him.
Yeah.
Because he's funny.
Yeah, he's funny.
And then I saw in the Ukraine, I don't know if you saw this, a comedian became president.
Yeah, I saw it.
Is that actually gonna be a political strategy? Is just get people who are funny? Or is it charismatic? And that's always been part of the presidential election.
Yeah, well, I think what the bigger thing is, people who are not really sort of entrenched in that long-term political world mm-hmm. can now, via the powers of social media and the internet and having large followings, can enter that arena and toss their hat in there and actually be legitimate contenders. I mean, if my Twitter keeps going the way it is, I mean, even as it is now, I could probably run to become an MP in the UK.
Are you going to do it?
Not now, but there's people who want me to.
Would you do it?
In the future, maybe sometime. But I've got other goals I want to achieve first. Like, it's not, I don't want to get entrenched in the politics world right now.
Between now and a time where you would run for politics, what is Zuby's life look like? Like, what are you optimizing for?
So I want to become an internationally known and renowned and successful musician.
Okay.
And author.
Okay.
And podcaster and public speaker.
Sounds like you can get that shit done by the end of this week. only those four, that's it?
To begin with.
That you have to will you only be satisfied if you are successful at all four of those? Or
No.
Would you be okay if you just were
successful? If I was just like a super global rap star, I mean, that would be pretty cool. it's just, you know, like Kendrick Lamar's doing all right. He hasn't written a book yet. You know, like, so.
What two rap artists would you pay to listen to them have a weekly podcast?
Ooh. Oh, wow.
I know exactly who my two are.
Really?
Yeah, but you go first.
Really? Do you mean them doing it together or just having their own ones?
Together.
Oh, together?
Together.
Oh, gosh. Man, I haven't... I feel like I need to think about this a little. Who are yours?
Kanye West and 50 Cent. Because Kanye would be saying all kinds of wild shit and 50 would just be keep yelling in the microphone, give me my money by Monday.
Yeah, that would be funny.
And they would just be calling people out. Like, they would just be absurd.
Yeah.
The two of those sitting in front of microphones.
Yeah, that's actually a good shout.
And just to the point where it's kind of like, what's that guy, Rob Dyrdek or whatever, the skateboard guy? He had a show here in the U.S. called Ridiculous or Ridiculousness or something. It was just like kind of like America's Funniest Home Videos, but, you know, like more modern version of it. Mm-hmm. I feel like those two guys alone would just have like their whole highlight reel of ridiculousness, right? Walk, hey, man, what you want to talk about today? I don't know, Kanye. What I saw that you were on, you know, TV whatever.
Yeah, that would be funny.
And they would just go wild.
Yeah, that would be funny. Hey, I'm down with that.
Who's the GOAT?
Ooh, there's no one GOAT. There's no single one. There's no single
one. Who are the top three?
Top three? Jay-Z.
Agreed.
Tech N9ne. And Eminem.
I'll give you two of the three. Eminem and Jay-Z.
Okay.
Tech N9ne is pretty good.
Pretty good, come on.
But I don't know if it's top three.
I think he is. He hasn't had, you know, he's, nah. Tech N9ne's ridiculous, dude.
All right.
But it almost depends to me. That's for me in my
That's fair. That era. Is your, but yeah, that is your top three.
Yeah, that's mine.
Which is somebody else.
Yeah, and it's also a factor of that is like my era. Had I been born 10 years earlier, my top three might be like, I don't know.
Biggie,
Rakim, and Cool G Rap or something, right? You know, and then
not Destiny's Child.
If I were, no, If I were born 10 years later, it might be like J. Cole, Kendrick, and Drake or something, you know? So, it depends on people's era as well.
All right, before I let you go, because I know you got to get going, aliens, you a believer? Not a believer? You think they're real?
You know, for some reason, when you said aliens, I was thinking, I was like, I am an alien here right now.
You want to hear something funny is in China, so on WeChat, I interviewed a guy who's an ancient alien researcher, which is a whole thing, right? But basically, he believes 780,000 years ago,
how do you make money off that?
there's an alien aircraft that like busted up in the solar system and crashed into Earth, whatever. So, crazy stuff.
Okay.
Somehow, me interviewing an ancient alien researcher got translated in Mandarin onto this very large WeChat channel that Anthony Pompliano interviewed an alien. And somebody I know in China sent it to me. He's like, yo, dude, they think you interviewed an alien.
That's amazing.
And so now I can say I actually interviewed a real alien. Yeah, I'm an alien, right? But all right, so what? Believer, non-believer?
Yeah, I think there's likely to be aliens. I think the probability is higher that there are than isn't, given the vast expanses of space and the galaxy and the universe.
So you're more of like a math probability. It's gotta happen.
Yeah, it makes sense.
You think they've visited Earth?
I mean, some of those people on Twitter, man.
But my favorite thing, that anyone's ever answered this with is when asked about aliens, they say, what do you mean? We are the aliens.
Mm.
Right? Like basically, reason why I used to ask the question was one night I was laying in bed and I turned to my girlfriend. I said, yo, this is going to be weird, but why does no one ever talk about alien pets? We always think of it as like one single homogeneous like species.
Yeah.
And they're going to like come here and they're little like green men or whatever. Mm. I was like, you think they got pets? like they got a little alien like dog or something?
Yeah,
and she was like, busy, shut up and go to sleep, right?
No, I think they would. When I think of aliens, I think of there being different, like a whole ecosystem. Like a whole just different ecosystem. So just like, you know, we've got humans and cats and dogs and different types of trees and plants.
Yeah,
like
so you think similar.
Yeah, I'd imagine like another planet, but you just got totally different species of all of those things. Almost like, I don't know, like Pokemon kind of thing.
Yeah.
Like it's just a whole another ecosystem and world.
Yeah.
That's how I think of it.
All right, last question for you. I'm assuming you're familiar with this meme / whole truther thing in the U.S. Epstein didn't kill himself?
Of course he didn't.
What's your thoughts? You think no way?
No way.
Really?
Really? Like that's one of the things where like the conspiracy theory is far more believable than the actual story.
I'll give you that.
Like when that thing happened, I mean that was like one of those like rare bipartisan agreements. That was, everyone was like, no, that's fishy.
literally on Twitter, there was like congressmen who were like, nah, no way. I remember that, like when the news came out, I literally remember being shocked at the types of people. Like people who would be very reserved, would never tweet any conspiracy theory, whatever. They were immediately like, no fucking way.
That's too many conveniences, man. Too many conveniences. Oh, the CCTV like all just stopped working and
technical issues, right?
Mm-hmm. On someone that high profile.
I think it's the perfect example of 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody questions anything.
Yeah.
The internet breaks up that monopoly.
Yeah, true.
Like the people on Twitter being like, no fucking way.
Yeah. I was more shocked by how brazen it was. I was like, you guys expect us to believe this? I was like, what? Then the story came out. I was like, oh, nothing to see here. It's like, no, hang on.
Did you see the guy who was on television recently? He had a dog and somebody was interviewing him. And they ask him like a super serious question at the end. He's like, just finish up, whatever. And then at the very end, he just goes, Epstein didn't kill himself.
Yeah, I did see
on
that.
On live TV.
I did see that.
I was like, man, it's like Harambe. Remember the gorilla?
Oh, Harambe was funny.
Yeah, Harambe was an inside job.
Yeah, that was funny. Yeah.
All right, man. Where can people find you on Twitter, on website?
Yeah.
So basically, listen, this is my endorsement. I've never endorsed a single fucking thing on this podcast. Go buy the music, go buy the t-shirts, the hats, his book, everything else.
Awesome. So I'm zubymusic.com, zubymusic.com, and at zubymusic on all social media. Definitely follow me on Twitter. I'm also on YouTube, Instagram, and Facebook as well, at zubymusic.
All right, and the books are on
Zubi. Yeah, you can get the book at teamzubi.com as well as the merchandise. My book, Strong Advice, Zubi's Guide to Fitness for Everybody. Ebook out now, physical, doing pre-orders, audiobook pre-orders coming very soon. And yeah, my podcast, Real Talk with Zubi, is available on iTunes, Spotify, YouTube, etc.
Look, man, you're basically what NBC, CBS, etc. used to be. It's just you now. You're the last hope. So keep doing what you're doing. We appreciate it, and we'll have to do this again sometime in the future.
Appreciate it, man.
Hey, everyone. Pop here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.